This is Audible.
Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Yesterday's Space Mage by Timothy Ellis. Narrated by Kevin T. Collins. 1. When you're 16 years old and it's the most important day of your life, the one thing you are not prepared for is dying. I mean, why would you be? Who would even see it coming? Not me. I'd been waiting for this day for 2 long years. More like all my life, but officially 2 years. At the age of 14, all boys are put through a 2-year apprenticeship, aimed at finding out what they have an aptitude for. If the masters like them enough to want to spend more years training them, and what each boy actually likes and wants to do. You spend a set time with each, and you do what they tell you to do. Liking it isn't part of the tasks, but that is what it's supposed to reveal, among other things. On your 16th birthday, each boy gets to choose, which is why it's called the Day of Choice. Everyone in the family dresses up, and at exactly midday, meet with friends and their families at the town hall. There, the masters gather, cast their evaluations into the choice box, from which the mayor draws each one and announces it. The choice box is divided up into slots, each one for a life choice and specifically ordered, so each announcement is always drawn in the same order, from lowest to highest. The assumption is a boy destined for a higher calling will always get a yes to each of the lower ones. On this basis, the one thing every boy dreads is 4 no's in a row, because at that point, everything stops. So one of 2 things happens normally. The boy waits until he gets 4 no's and makes a choice from the yeses. Or he waits for all of them to be announced, suffering dread with each no, and still having reached the end, chooses what he really wants to do. Of course, we all hope for the latter. The majority, though, suffer from limited choice. On some days, more than one boy goes through this. And dare I call it an ordeal, because this is your whole future on the line here. In this case, you go in order of birth time, so whoever goes last has the longest to wait. And believe me, the waiting is a killer. Fortunately, today, there's only me. You don't sleep the night before. You can't eat the morning meal. Your mouth goes dry no matter how much you drink. And drinking too much has side effects. Your mother fusses over your clothes, and you feel like puking. You can't concentrate and become clumsy. So we get told, and so it was. The walk to the town hall at least eases the physical symptoms, but this is your future about to be decided. And here's the irony. It's decided by the masters, in spite of the choice being made by the boy, because the masters are the ones who make the offers. No offer, no choice. And it does happen sometimes. You get a boy who's not really capable of doing anything right, or one with a really bad attitude, or who is just plain mean or even evil, and no one wants to train them. These boys leave the town and rarely ever come back. I had no worries on this count, though. I'm serious and withdrawn until you get to know me, and when you do, you get the full force of my sense of humor. This isn't necessarily a good thing, since a very serious master hates having a wisecracking boy to train, but all the same, I don't consider myself a wisecracker. I'm not even sure I'm funny. Although people do laugh. But I digress. Arriving at the town hall means meeting and greeting everyone, thankfully informally. A quick handshake with those offering hands, nods to others, and the inevitable hugs from elderly female relatives. At the appointed hour, you stand in the center of the master's circle, facing the mayor, and they all decide your fate, while making you think it's actually your choice. So there I stood. Mother gives me a smile. Father is looking serious to hide his nervousness. The sisters are waiting for me to be left with options they can laugh at. The midday bells ring out. No one moves. There is no sound until after the 12th bell. The mayor takes the box around the circle. Each evaluation is slotted in, and he comes back around to his place and faces me. "Young Thorne," he says, supposedly to me, but it's theater for everyone. "Are you ready to make your choice?" "I am," I croaked, causing my sisters to laugh before they were quickly silenced by many looks. "Let us begin." The first ones are always farming. Basic farmhand, animal farmer, crop farmer, hunter, mechanic. Each evaluation comes out deliberately, and one by one is flourished and read out. There is no hurry, only a slow presentation. The timing for the whole ceremony never varies by more than a minute or two. Yes, 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 and yes. No surprise there. Farming work is a no-brainer. Animals like me, and I can get the job done. Bored out of my brain, but doable. The next ones are all town-related. General maintenance, builder, utilities, administration, town constables. Yes, 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 and yes. Being a constable was interesting, but I'd hate it. The rest was more boredom. After this, you get introduced to the military, with a period of training first, and this is where most boys bomb out. If they can't get fit enough, won't take commands, won't take serious discipline imposed on them, or simply can't handle being a soldier, well, these get the first no. The problem is, this no is quickly followed by four more, regardless of how you actually did in them. I did manage to make it in the fitness department, just, and the rest of it was a matter of figuring out the smart way of doing it, so I wasn't expecting a no here. Yes. Training is followed by administration, mechanicals, weapons, and tactics, and my personal favorite, war games, which you only get into if you're good at tactics. Admin bores me, but I can get the job done. I'm not all that mechanical-minded, but like farming, I can do basic repairs, and while under threat of live fire. I was most disappointed to find I wasn't all that good with weapons, but in tactics I excelled, allowing me to win more often than I lost, simply by outthinking the opponent. War games, though. Introduce some strategy to tactics, and I was almost unbeatable. The first yes had me breathing again, not having been aware I'd stopped, and it was followed by yes, 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 and yes. The weapons yes was a surprise, I have to admit it. Presumably I was better than I thought I was, or had beaten the averages some way. At this point, I started noting some surprised looks. People who should have known me better, wondering how I'd managed to get so far. And the truth is, those who get past training usually get their first no's here. Those who get a yes on training, but no's in all the rest, still make good foot soldiers and usually choose to be. Those with a yes or two in the next four will choose the one they liked the most, it being very rare for someone who yeses on training to actually choose something before. The masters have a lot to do with this. We get told if we are soldier material or not, and so we mostly know if the training is going to be a yes or no. The only reason you get the yes without any other yeses is because they still want you to be a soldier. Sometimes there is potential there, which many years later becomes a valuable skill, and the masters can recognize such a thing in a trainee, even if they're crap at normal military stuff. A lot of good, solid sergeants are made this way. And now we come to the big ones. Every boy is tested for magical ability. You either have it, or you don't. If you didn't, you were sent back for more military training. If you did, the first yes is guaranteed. If you actually like magic, this is what you've been waiting for. Yes, of course I knew this, but it shocked everyone except my closest family. Having demonstrated magical ability, you receive training in the healing arts, the making arts, the movement arts, and lastly, battle magic. I found I could certainly heal, could make something small just by thinking it, could move small objects from place to place, or make them disappear completely, and once even moved myself a short distance. But battle magic is something else again, using parts of all of them and going way beyond. I surprised my master by forming an effective shield against both physical and magical attack, almost as soon as being instructed how. Yes, yes, yes. No real surprise. I'd demonstrated enough to show I could become good at any of them, given enough time. The mayor hesitated, uncertainty on his face, his eyes seeking the magician's approval to read the last one. The battle mage reluctantly nodded. The crowd became puzzled, and so was I. I was expecting a no. Although I was good at what they'd taught me, I'd lost my temper with another student once, and force-punched him clear over the compound wall. It showed I could put a lot more force in my punch than even I knew I could, but he'd needed a healer and a week in bed. I'd spent 2 days using my punch to demolish an old wall in the town as a way of punishing my temper. I'd been convinced right then I'd never be accepted as a battle mage. So I didn't know how to interpret the tension now evident in the masters. The mayor looked back at me.
Young Thorn, only a dozen times before has any boy made it to this point without a no along the way. Only once before, and never in our town, has a boy not received a no. Most magicians have a skill in one direction only. Those who can do more tend to be strong in one and weak in the others, so they're only given a yes for the one they're strong in. Good battle mages usually have no's among the mundane work, simply because magic is wasted on the mundane, and the mundane task cannot hold a mage's focus, so the boy does badly without knowing why. A mage who is good at healing, making, and moving usually fails at tactics and strategy, so has already had several mundane no's, even though they may now get 4 yes, but a final no. This happens rarely, and the boy gets to choose where to specialize. Do you wish to specialize in one of these 3 branches of magic, young Thorn?
Everyone looked at him, dumbfounded. I'd never heard of someone being asked to choose before the last evaluation was given. There was a slight look of desperation on his face now, and sweat began dripping down his cheek. I had no understanding of what was going on, and no one else appeared to either, except the mages now all looked resigned, and were quickly followed by the military as understanding caught up. I wish I knew what they obviously did. Everyone looked from him to me.
"You want me to choose now?" I stammered.
"Yes, lad."
"Why?"
"Because every choice has consequences, even when you have no idea of them. You have not had a no. If we don't hear the last evaluation, you will become the second ever to receive all yes, which will mark you for greatness.
but will limit me to only one branch of magic. Yes, perhaps this is not an issue for you. He sounded hopeful. I sighed. My first no, but it was mine, not theirs, and it didn't count. I wanted to be a battle mage. I have to know, I responded, looking him in the eye.
So be it, young Thorn. You have chosen.
This was definitely odd. Being told you'd chosen was a formality after you made a formal choice. I hadn't reached that stage yet, even though I'd indicated I wanted to be able to choose to be a battle mage. He swept a look around the room, and I followed his eyes where I could. No one had any idea what was going on, it seemed. His eyes lingered by the door on a hooded figure I hadn't known was standing there. There was no visible face. The hood nodded. The mayor plucked out the last evaluation, looked at it, made brief eye contact with the battle mage, and opened his mouth.
Yes.
The room went crazy, and so I missed the entrance of the second hooded man. Both of them moved to the circle of masters, and to my alarm, they all rose and backed away, pulling their chairs with them. The crowd was forced to back away behind them, jubilation turning to alarm. I was left standing to face the two hooded men.
"Your name is Thorn," said the shorter man. "You will bend your knee and swear allegiance to the great king above all," said the slightly taller, without waiting for my answer to the first question.
"What?" I asked, not understanding anything.
"Jump away and run," said the voice of the battle mage in my head. "Go, now."
"You chose to be a battle mage," said Short. "You are only the second boy to receive all yes. Do you know who the first was?"
"How would I?"
"Your king was the first," said Tall. "You will swear allegiance to him now. He will be your master from now on."
"What?"
I said. "I chose to be a battle mage for this town. I don't know this king you speak of."
"He knows you. From the moment you showed magical talent in more than one of the arts, he has been watching you."
"Spying on me?" "A king does not spy. He watches. And you better start showing some respect, lad, or else." I couldn't help it. My temper was fraying rapidly. Nothing had prepared me for this sort of confrontation. Maybe not quite true. I'd been bullied before, and found I hated bullies. They pushed a button I couldn't stop being pressed. It was why I'd expected the last to be no. And here I was, having that button pressed again.
"Or else what?"
"You defy your king?" Short sounded outraged. "What?" I asked. "I don't know what's going on here."
"Kneel or die," yelled Short. "Do it now."
My eyes went to the town battle mage. He looked angry, but his stance was deliberately open. It was obvious he was showing he was not about to use any magic to help me in case he brought the wrath of the king down on the town. I raised my eyebrows in his direction. He nodded. But I wasn't given time to summon the energy to jump myself away. Masters could move themselves in seconds. I couldn't. Tall threw his arm forward, and lightning surged at me. I responded with a shield, and was immediately surrounded by it. But it wasn't powerful enough, so I reached down inside me as I'd been taught, and summoned forth raw power to boost my shielding. I took the blow without flinching, and stood there, feet planted solidly.
"What?" roared Short,
and he sent a white ball at me. I deflected it with a thought. Behind the magic, I knew I couldn't hold very long, and began on the jump. Shields are easy. Just call it into being, and it's there. Jumps require a destination you know well. You needed to focus on the place, check it for a clear place to move to, lest you jump into a solid object, or worse, a person, and then move yourself. Only, I'd never done this behind a shield before.
"Use our magic, Thorn," said the battle mage in my head. "Jump as far away as you can."
I could feel the flow of energy to me, reinforcing my shield as the two hooded mages seemed to throw everything they had at me. With a thought, I used the shield as a way of using the energy being thrown at me, and as my shield grew stronger, I siphoned enough of it to power my jump. Both attacking mages now had their hoods back, and their faces revealed a combination of surprise and horror. The jump to a secluded glade I knew of formed in my mind. It was empty, and I prepared to move myself. Things happened at once. My mother yelled out my name, causing me to look in her direction, breaking my concentration. The mages threw every last method of attack they knew at me. A man wearing a crown on his head appeared beside them and threw the largest white ball I'd ever seen into my shields. I instructed myself to jump. Everything went white. 2. They told me I was fished out of the water by a boat's crew, after having popped to the surface almost in front of them. I was out cold, and they couldn't revive me. I woke up in a white room, with a lot of metal stuff in it making a lot of light, and with several people dressed in white doing things beyond my comprehension. I'd never seen anything like this before, and understandably, I completely freaked. I'd have thought aliens, only they were people like me. This was made worse by one of them coming towards me making noises I didn't understand. There was a sudden pain in my arm, and everything went black this time. When I woke again, I could understand them. As far as I could later gather, while I slept, they'd used an experimental teaching gizmo designed for young kids to train my brain with basic concepts, including language. At that point, I could make out what they were saying, but understood very little of it. However, enough took a hold for me to understand I was in a place of healing, and these were the local healers. They kept me there for a week. I'd woken up in pain across most of my body, and especially in my head. They tested me many different ways to find out why, and while over the week most of my body stopped hurting, the pain in my head remained. In the end, they gave me a series of small round things in different colors to swallow, until they found something which removed the pain, at least for a while. I learned a new word, migraine, and discovered no one knew what caused them. Nor did anyone seem to care about finding out beyond the basic tests already done. They asked me questions I couldn't answer. Where was I from? How did I get into the water? Since I had no reference to where I was from couldn't be answered. I had no idea how I came to be in the water, so there was no answer to give. At one point, I mentally yelled at them to stop asking me stupid questions, and shortly after, they did. They told me I had something called amnesia, and I might or might not get my memories back. For now, though, they recommended I relearn anything I found I didn't know, and my memory would fix itself, or not. It was a relief for the questions to stop, and I said nothing to encourage them to start up again. When they took me somewhere to live, the only reason I didn't give in to stark terror at what the city I was in looked like, what the people wore, moved around in, and were buying and selling, was I was fascinated at the same time. Being moved long distances in a noisy box seemed incredible, and no matter how hard the big woman next to me tried to explain anything, I had no context with which to make any sense of it. I spent the next 2 years in a large house with other kids who had no parents. They put a TV in my room, and I spent every hour I could watching it, in between lessons and the daily migraine pain. If I thought my last 2 years had been mainly boring, these two were much more so, because I didn't actually do much except sit and absorb information. Of the two, TV was more entertaining than lessons, although its reliability was less so.
Neither told me what I most wanted to know. There were two things I really wanted to find out, and I learned the skills I needed to find the information I wanted. Between TV and net, I found I could access most of it. The first was obviously, where the hell was I? The second was why there was no magic here. Of these two, I found the latter bothered me the most. It took me over a year to put the pieces together of both. A sort of friend introduced me to someone who did Reiki healing. She showed me how to make the healing energy flow and was amazed at how powerful I was. It was my first access to magic since I got here. It wasn't anywhere near what I'd had, even in my largely untrained state, as something about where I was dampened it. But knowing it was there somewhere, and I had to figure out how to access it, made me all the more determined to find a way. I read everything I could find, with even a hint of magic in it. Almost all of it was made up, and most of that was based on clueless. What wasn't made up was worse, since it didn't actually work, just fooled the wielder into doing something stupid. I went looking for anyone with natural magical ability and found all the magic entertainers to be fakes. Oddly, those claiming spiritual powers turned out to be accessing a crude form of magic while having no idea what they were really doing, attributing things to a higher power. More often than not, they were accessing a lower power, pretending to be a higher power. Once I figured it out, I stayed well clear of them. The made-up stuff in books turned out to hold the clues I needed, especially when cross-referenced with some of the spiritual stuff. I laughed at the whole concept of wand-waving, hand-waving, and spells. The magic I knew came from the deep parts of the being, focused with a clear mind and cast with intent. You didn't need a poem to do good magic, just a very clear idea of what you wanted. But I guess when you have no magic, you invent ways to entertain using it. Useless as it was, there were gems in the rubbish. Early learning tended to use movements and objects to start you off, but if you needed a wand by the end of training, they gave you a no. Force punching was a little different, since an actual punch clarified the intent perfectly, but you were expected to not need them either. What I found was the physical punch put an extra erg into the damage done, hence my spurning anything relying on objects and actions. The concept of yin-yang provided me with my first breakthrough. When I finally understood the concept of time, I found the day was exactly as I knew it to be, which meant I hadn't moved very far from where the town hall had been. This suggested I'd been found exactly where the town hall was, or maybe the glade I'd been aiming for, and it was underwater for some reason. An article on the net suggested the seas had risen a long way thousands of years earlier, and much of the land had been flooded back then. After some searching, I found an underwater map of the oceans of the world itself being something I'd learned about some months earlier, and at first sat there gaping at how big it actually was. My world had been no more than a half-day's ride outside my village. To find it was so big was mind-boggling. The underwater one showed the depths of the water, and on it I recognized the shape of the coastline not far from our town. The implication was staggering. I'd jumped through time. How far was almost impossible to determine, but this is where yin-yang came into my thinking. I was looking at what was known of the past through information gleaned from the very rock of the world itself, and came across a reference to the age of the planet.
It was suggested the planet was some 4.5 billion years old, but the interesting thing was it had another 4.5 to go before it died. This meant it was about in the middle of its life. Yin-yang is balanced at the middle. The early part of existence is yin, the latter half is yang. So if the world had just entered its yang phase, the yang magic would not have yet had a chance to manifest, and if I jumped across the changeover from yin to yang, hence, no magic. But did no magic apply to me? It meant the magic I was taught was yin magic, but I'd also been taught magic was magic. You had it or you didn't, and the application was unique to each person. So magic had changed in nature, and in theory, all I needed to do was change the way I accessed it. People now had no access because it hadn't yet formed. Mine was there, it was active, and all I needed was the key to using it now. I taught myself how to meditate, followed the exercises and recommendations to clear my mind, and when I'd not had a single thought for 10 minutes one afternoon, I sought the magic at the core of my being. It was there, but it felt blocked. No matter how I tried, there was a barrier of some sort between me and the magical energy. Magic isn't real. The thought popped in there, and I pondered it. Yes, all the made-up stuff was based on this. Magic wasn't real. So the simple belief of millions, if not billions, of people was in itself a tangible blockage. So all I needed was different intent. The belief of others does not and never will affect my magic, I said out loud. And immediately, I felt the surge of energy I'd first experienced on my first day of magic training. With my eyes still closed, I focused on the room. I felt the TV and pressed in the on-off switch. The TV came on. I did it again, and it went off. The urge to keep doing it was overwhelming. I grinned to myself. Over the next few weeks, I practiced alone, gaining strength and power, range and control. I quickly learned not to do magic around other people. They didn't appreciate it, even when it was supposed to help them. But when I was alone, I repaired broken crockery and ornaments, made small things I needed but could not afford to buy, and got into trouble when someone demanded to know where things came from, and they assumed I'd stolen them. Bullies learned to stay away from me, as there was no satisfaction in hitting someone who showed no pain from being hit. I practiced holding shields as long as I could, as often as I could, trying to build them up. This world was much more randomly dangerous than the one I'd grown up in, and I set out to protect myself as best I could. Shielding exercises led to hiding ones. I figured out how to change the shields so I couldn't be seen, and immediately learned the steam in the girl's bathroom still revealed an invisible shape. No one knew what the vague shape had been, but the scream still shocked me to the core and left me shaken and subdued for days. A sports accident caused me to limp for a week, and I began short-distance movement magic again, progressively moving further and further with each jump. By the time I could walk without limping again, people had noticed I'd started arriving at places early, when I was usually a bit late. Not being seen doing the jump was the main constraint against using them, and often it was impossible, but I did quickly find places to jump from and to, which rarely saw traffic. At least once, I was accused of using a broom closet for hanky-panky purposes. I wished. I learned all I could, practiced everything regularly, attempted to stay partially fit, but as much as I tried, my form became a bit rounder than a warrior's ought to be.
There was a time limit on how long I could stay here, as once you reached 18, they kicked you out to find your own way, and once they did, I'd need to find a way to make a living. Joining the military was an option, but battle mage wasn't something offered here. Everything else was a letdown to my mind. What I saw of boot camp on TV put me right off. I'd been through it once, but this version was so much worse. Being bored for the rest of my life was a definite possibility. The skills I'd learned before arriving here were useful for many things, albeit needing some upgrading. I'd picked up the tech fairly easily, but things were done differently here. Life went on. I dated girls every now and then, without any real success at relationships. Until one day, on my 18th birthday, which had been determined by medical means, mere hours before I was due to officially leave to find my own way in the world, I meditated, focusing on the mountaintop I'd been taken to as a young teen. It had a distinctive peak, required 3 days' walk to get to it, and another 3 to return home. A grand adventure at that age, usually done just before turning 14. Now, it was a link I hoped was still there. In my mind, I saw the place where we camped, but it looked different somehow. The actual peak looked the same from off to one side, but the camp area had changed. I concentrated on the spot and willed myself to move there. There wasn't where I thought it was, being a considerable way below where I materialized. I began to fall immediately. I had seconds to concentrate on an air cushion to stop me splatting myself on the rocks below, and achieved enough of one so I only hit hard enough to woof the air out of my lungs, but without breaking anything. "Who's there?" yelled a voice. I wasn't yet able to move, let alone speak, but I could see, and a strangely dressed man, even by the standards of here and now, came around a rock, pointing some sort of fantasy ray gun at me. He looked at me for a long moment and shot me. 3. The room I woke up in appeared to be a big metal box with a door in one side. It was packed full of randomly abandoned stuff, suggesting I was in some sort of storage area. I was sitting up against a round metal thing going floor to ceiling, hands behind my back, and unable to be moved apart or very far from the metal. I was quite surprised to find I didn't have any holes in me. I was beginning to think getting out of bed on my birthdays was a really bad idea. 2 years ago, they'd tried to kill me. Last year, I'd been in a fight with the school bully and had to use some of my military training to put him down before he did some real hurt to me. I'd tried force-punching him, but at that time, I hadn't worked out here-and-now magic, so it hadn't worked. The punch had broken a rib, though, and I'd nursed a very sore wrist for days after. And this year, I get shot and locked up in a storage room who knows where. Actually, where wasn't the really strange thing. The room was metal. I'd never seen a metal room before. I'd heard of them on ships, but never seen one. Was I on a ship? If so, how had they moved me so far so fast, and without anyone asking questions about it? Even stranger, every TV ship I'd seen constantly moved in the water. There was no sense of movement here at all. Where wasn't going to be solved sitting here like a trussed chicken. My hands and legs were bound with plastic strips, and my hands were behind me and also tied to the metal round thing. I moved myself enough so I could see the tie holding me there and concentrated on a small chunk of it. It vanished, going to wherever it was the things I made vanish went to. Finding out where was something we were supposed to do in training, but I'd never made it that far. It was on my list of things to do. With my body being able to move more, I twisted myself around so I could see my hands and did the same thing. The tie dropped away. I repeated it on the one around my ankles and stood up, or rather tried to. I'd made it partly upright before my legs gave way, and I dropped back down again. For several minutes, I rubbed my legs, flowing healing into them, and again stood. This time I made it, although I felt weak and wobbly. Whatever they'd shot me with seemed to affect the body more than just knocking you out. If nothing else, I wanted me one of those. I needed to make sure I could shield myself from it, assuming one was likely to be fired at me again. Now I knew something like it existed, I could throw a shield up to protect myself, but without trying it, I wouldn't know if what I did would be effective or not. A knockout gun wasn't a physical attack in the context I knew of, and it wasn't a magical attack either. Although technically, now I was thinking about it, it had to use some form of energy, and energy could be considered magical, so maybe I was fine. Note to self, avoid finding out the hard way. The door was locked, or I assumed it was locked, since I couldn't move it. Locks were something I'd had to learn about, since we hadn't had anything like it at home, or even the need for one. This door had what I assumed was a lock, although it looked nothing like what I'd seen and used before. I took a moment to get the square of lock area fixed in my mind, and concentrated on vanishing a cube. The lock vanished, and by bending down, I could now see out into a passageway. It was also metal, and deserted. There was a faint hum in the background, but otherwise, no noise at all. The door pulled inwards, and I stepped out. The passageway was as filthy as the storage room had been. Left or right? Right went towards the faint hum, so I assumed this was towards the ship's engines, assuming, as I was on a ship. I couldn't think of anywhere else I'd be. I turned left and tried to creep quietly along, stepping over any obvious debris to avoid making any loud noises. The room next door also had a locked door, and I removed the lock with a thought and pushed the door open. Inside, the room was somewhat cleaner and contained a bed. On the bed was a girl. She ignored my entry and continued ignoring me as I went over to her. I leaned down to speak softly to her, but suddenly froze. She hadn't been ignoring me. She was dead. I'd seen dead before, during my military training, and this was it. There was a cover over most of her, and I drew it back to see what killed her. Underneath, I found she was naked, with huge bruises over a lot of her body. I turned away, dropping the cover, and threw up in the corner. It wasn't long before I recovered, and the only bad thing about making the mess vanish was the clean spot in the corner was now very obvious. I went back to the bed and looked at the girl again. She'd been very pretty. There was no smell, and when I touched her shoulder, it was still warmish. She hadn't been dead long. I left her as she was and returned to the passageway, but my temper was now aroused. I wanted to find who'd killed her and do the same to them. Which was, of course, probably a really stupid thing to do, but hey, I'd been shot, kidnapped, tied up, and found out what they did to captives. It would make you mad, too. I channeled some calming energy, as I'd been taught. A warrior goes into battle calm, using his head as much as his sword, shield, war machine, and magic. I was calm. Furious, but calm. I continued along to the left, looking into rooms, most of which were not locked, until I heard voices. I understood nothing they said, and I had to rack my brains to remember how to access translation magic. On the battlefield, being able to understand what your enemy was yelling made the difference between blundering around and being prepared. I hadn't expected to need to use it so soon, and paused until the intent manifested, and the end of a sentence was actually understood. I crept up to the side of the door, through which the voices were coming, and peeked inside. The sight beyond the two people in there made me look again. This wasn't a ship on the sea. We were in space. 4.
"I'm not telling the boss she's dead," said the one on the left. "You did it. You tell him."
"Do we have to tell him?"
"Dumbo, we went there to prove we could, and the instruction was bring back one of each sex for assessment on their worth as slaves, and you buggered the girl and killed her. How do you intend telling him why we only have one prisoner?"
"We could say she died trying to escape."
"You think the boss will believe that?"
"He will, if we kill the other one, too."
"Are you nuts? We didn't get told to bring back two bodies."
"But if both of them are dead, there's no reason for anyone to doubt we had to shoot them to prevent them escaping."
"But you didn't shoot her."
"A minor detail which can be fixed. I'll shoot the other one at the same time."
"I think not," said a voice, making the two turn suddenly towards me. It took me a moment to understand it had been my voice. By the time I figured it out, both of them were raising guns in my direction. Being seated slowed them down, but they were fast enough all the same. My left hand formed a fist and jerked at the one on the left. The force punch took him in the chest and smashed him into the console. There was a snapping noise as his back and one arm broke, and the top half of his body continued onto the console itself. The right one got a shot off at me, but it bounced off my shield. I concentrated on his gun and removed it. He screamed as blood started gushing from the stump of his arm. In my haste, I'd removed his hand as well as the gun, well above the wrist. He tried to stem the loss of blood, but the artery had been severed without being cauterized, as if I'd used a sword and cut it off, and he bled out while I stood there gaping at him. I obviously needed some practice. I'd hoped to keep at least one of them alive for answers and for flying the ship. Now I had to hope there was someone else on board. Someone still alive. The ship flew on. I stood there, not knowing what to do next, and the ship continued flying. Obviously, some sort of autopilot had control. There was nothing I could see which told me where we were going, and no way of stopping us going there. And while I dithered, we were getting further away from where I wanted to be. The pool of blood eventually stopped spreading. Movement behind me made me turn suddenly, shield back up, and fists clenched, but it was only a metallic, spider-like robot, about as big as a large dog. It stopped when it registered I was in its way. I stepped back to see what it would do, and it walked into what I now knew was the bridge of a spaceship. I'd seen plenty of entertainment about them, and this was definitely a bridge. Even if no one making the entertainment had any idea spaceships were real. Three more followed it, and between them they lifted the two bodies and carried them out. Blood dripped a trail down the passageway, but this was quickly removed by a lot of smaller robots, and any evidence of death vanished. I decided to follow them, and this was where things became really weird. The little robots were cleaning off the blood on the deck, but only the blood on the deck. They ignored all the other crud, resulting in a nice, clean trail through an otherwise filthy environment. As I followed them, I pondered why anyone would limit cleaning robots to just dead bodies and blood. By the time we reached what looked like a hospital room and the cold storage room on the other side of it, I could think of only one group who'd constantly want blood removed.
slavers.
5. Knowing you're on a slaver ship isn't actually useful information. Sure, at some point I was going to need to deal with whoever met the ship, presumably also slavers. I could hope the ship would be intercepted by some sort of police force, but there was a chance they'd simply destroy the ship and ask questions later, which wasn't much use for me. Having almost died twice in 2 years, I wasn't looking forward to the next time. The girl was also in the cold store, so it contained 3 bodies. I shut the door on them. I spent the next few hours searching the whole ship, but I was now completely alone. I sat in a now clean bridge seat and pondered what to do. I knew nothing about spaceships. Nothing around me was in any way intuitive or even helpfully labeled. There was no way I was going to be flying this ship, which meant I was going to wherever it was going. The next problem was, I didn't know where it was going, or how long it was going to take to get there, or who would be there to meet the ship, or how they would react to 3 dead bodies on board. Or, more importantly, how whoever met the ship was going to react to finding me on board with 3 dead bodies, especially since 2 of them were my handiwork, and I couldn't prove the other one wasn't. My stomach rumbled, pointing out a more immediate problem. I'd found what looked like a kitchen, but on first inspection, I wasn't at all sure how food was prepared, and exactly what was food. The ship wasn't all that big, so remembering where each room was hadn't been hard. The kitchen, at least, was clean. I hunted around until I found bottles of what I assumed was water, and did, in fact, turn out to be water. I downed one, threw it in what I assumed was the trash hopper, and started in on another one. Behind another door, I found a stack of sealed oblong containers, which had labels indicating they contained food. It was about the size of a buffet tray. I ripped one open, and if it was food, it was highly processed and almost unrecognizable. Adapting to processed food had been one of the easy things to do, accounting for not a small amount of the rounding of my midriff area. Desserts, especially, I'd been delighted to discover, and it had taken a medical specialist to persuade me to limit my intake. Kitchen technology had been a little more difficult, but net time provided understanding and instructions. The tech here was different, but I took a guess the glass door with the handle on it, with an inside just a tad bigger than the food container, was something akin to a microwave oven. I took down another one, pulled the door, pushed it in, and closed the door. There was an immediate hum, and a few seconds later, a ding. I pulled the door, pulled the container out, and took it to a table where I sat in front of it. This time, the top wrapping came away easily, taking the sides with it and leaving just a tray, revealing a meal. I went back, looking for eating utensils. My conversion to these had been the subject of much mirth at the home's dinner table, and it had taken more than a few meals, and laughter from everyone else, to adapt. Even now, I tend to cut everything up into bite sizes and then use the fork as a scoop for the whole meal. I dug into one end of the food, which tasted like chicken with 4 kinds of veg. The other end turned out to look like and taste like an apple crumble. I finished the meal and the water and trashed the remains. Pulling another water, I went back to the bedrooms, looking for one worth trying to sleep in. The first was the biggest, and sometime since I'd poked my nose in here before, the room had been cleaned and the bed made, but black satin sheets were definitely not my thing. The second bedroom was a bit smaller, and was more tastefully sheeted with white. Boring, but okay. I poked my nose into the ensuite, found the facilities also recently cleaned, figured out how to use them by trial and error, used them, and flopped down on the bed. I woke some 6 hours later with a throbbing head, and it was at this point I realized I didn't have my backpack, which was sitting on my bed back at the home, waiting for my return. In it were my migraine meds. I made my way to the medical bay and sat there for a while, trying to concentrate. One of the things I'd discovered early on was meds are expensive. They were also not given away lightly. After a day in major pain and no tablet to ease it, I'd snuck into the room storing the home's meds in the middle of the night and borrowed the bottle. I spent all night trying and failed to duplicate the tablets. The bottle was easy. Meds are not. However, I solved this the next night by taking a walk to the nearest med store. I stood outside in a dark place, and both bottle and tablets duplicated precisely into my hand. The thing to remember about creating anything is you need the raw materials at hand. The closer they are, the easier it is. When you copy something, you don't need to know what's in it. Just have access to everything needed. Your intent allows the copy to take place. So outside the med store, I first copied a tablet and took it immediately with a corresponding reduction in head pain shortly after. I upped the intent to the full bottle. I also linked the intent to the med store for future duplications. After that, I was able to create a new bottle from my room anytime I wanted. There is a downside to this, of course. The ingredients for the tablets were coming from somewhere inside the store, which meant, most likely, they were either coming from actual tablets or being leached out of anything which had what was needed. I hadn't focused the intent to this level, so didn't know what was happening. Although, over time, though, the med store did take on a certain reputation for some meds not working properly. I wonder why. I could have just moved actual bottles from the store to my hand, but that would have been actual stealing. I was creating from what was available, not stealing. I even managed to convince myself. I had a feeling I was too far away to do it now, especially with a full-on migraine. I concentrated on just a tablet, and just using what was within this room, and it materialized in my hand. I took it immediately and waited to see if it had the right effect. One of the downsides of creating something you actually eat is the only way to be sure about it is to eat it. Consequently, this is not recommended for all but experienced magic creators, but needs drive, and I was my own guinea pig. Getting it wrong could kill you, but I'd done this enough times. I was either going to get a tablet which worked, or more likely, not get one at all. It worked. As the pain receded, I created a whole bottle, and with nothing to put it in, I made a new backpack as well. I'd done several over the previous 2 years, so this one was easy. Head feeling much better, I took myself back to bed. As sleep was coming on, I idly wondered what had happened to the backpack I'd left behind, and what people had thought about me disappearing without it. 6. Weeks went by. I found a routine which worked. Eating, sleeping, gazing at the stars, and practicing magic. Not necessarily in that order. The food was filling, if mostly the same. If there was a breakfast menu, I never found it. Sleep was easy, as was staying clean. The ship seemed to have unlimited water, but perhaps one person wasn't stressing the system very much. I spent long hours gazing out the various windows. In my early teen years, I'd done a lot of stargazing, but during the last two, There hadn't been much to see. Too much light in a city. Now, though, I saw the galaxy in its wondrous majesty, and I couldn't get enough of it. There was, however, an urgency to figuring out how to survive getting wherever the ship was going. I'd go to bed with the intent of waking the moment any ship came close, something docked, or the ship docked. My worst nightmare was being woken up by slavers and marched into a cell, or the same cell, only by police. I had both nightmares, but they turned out not to be real. Magic is like anything. The more you practice, the better at it you get. Also,